Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Inside Scoop Live. This is one of many features presented to you by Reader Views. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today I'm chatting with Charlie Peterson about his new book, Turn of the Century 2100. But before we dive into his book, I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. Charlie emerged from the ranks of information technology, finance, and the aerospace private sector to write genre-blend novels that tackle contemporary issues. These tend to place his books in the world of science fiction and suspense. With a broad background that includes working with the Apollo Lunar Module Systems and the creation of what is now America's largest automated teller network, the STAR System, he was able to achieve a clear understanding of the human and organizational dynamics necessary to effect significant large change. Though Charlie was born on the East Coast, he now lives on the West Coast, is married, and has four sons. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Gail.
Good to have you with us. As we get underway here, Charlie, would you tell the audience a bit of the essence of your book, Turn of the Century 2100?
Yeah, Turn of the Century 2100 is a sci-fi-based international suspense. It's about what happens when a Berkeley, California quantum science lab and 12 other labs around the world are visited by a photon probe. That's an electromagnetic wave state entity in a hologram from Geneva, Switzerland in the year 2108. Well, right from the prologue, you can see where we're going. We're going to get into quantum science and time travel and contemporary issues. But as soon as you reach chapter one, you'll see this is about people brought together in the wake of discovery. In 2085, it's where we start, nine-year-old Allie visits her 105-year-old dying grandmother, great-grandmother, Allison, and is told that their destinies will be linked in about 20 years. Then we return to our time, and we find young Allison, that's great-granny of 2085, as a budding quantum physicist in Berkeley, California Science Lab. So when a photon probe from the future shows up, she begins to have an interaction with Jacques of Switzerland, the scientist from the year 2108. Kind of a quantum email crosses the space-time continuum. Well, then Harry Crocker shows up from the CIA to aid the science team because they recognize the threats and create essentially what I call a love quadrangle between Allison and Harry in our time and Jacques and Allie in the 22nd century. Then the evil doers show up, headed by a guy by the name of James Slaver from New York, from a group called WithInsight, meaning insight from within.
Mm-hmm.
They're an international band of technology mafia, white-collar criminals, and they bring together an international team and terrorists to engage the scientists, the CIA, and the Interpol all across the world, Geneva, London, Hamburg, Moscow, Beijing, Tokyo, and it all culminates in New York City. These people are trying to prevent world-changing directives, what we call oracles, from the future to reaching the floor of the UN General Assembly. So Turn of the Century 21 takes you down a path of what I call science faction.
Science faction, okay.
Between fact and fiction that can only be traveled by the imagination.
Okay. Well, now, Charlie, what is this your first book?
Yes, it is. It's one of a. It's designed to be a series.
Yay! That's wonderful. And the genre is science fiction, but as you said, it also has many facts in it as well. So you're really referring to it as science faction. You've created
right.
A new genre here, so to speak.
Yes, you know, science faction is the same genre that the Michael Crichtons and even Carl Sagan take you down.
Right. And now, Charlie, this is your first book. Why did you write this?
Well, I had a very successful career, and it was time to move on. And I said, well, what do I want to do? And I looked around, and I just thought of all the things that sort of aggravated me about all the chaos that's going on in our world today. And I said, you know, I've grown to be very much involved in very large-scale investments and very large-scale organizational dynamics, but you know, I really wanted to explore my creative side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured that writing was, I've written and I've been involved in various productions and I've, you know, made speeches and all those kinds of things. And I thought that this would be a, you know, a way that I could really, you know, sort of refocus my energies and perhaps not only bring a good story to the table, but add some relevance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And going back to your terminology, science faction. And in this book, now you're drawing into it, you know, romance and intrigue and science. And Allie, young Allie, grows up to become a particle physicist or part of a particle physicist team.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. One of the things you're going to find out, and one of the reasons I went down this road, is that this year and next year and actually the next couple of years, you're going to see more and more discussion about quantum science.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a major implementation in CERN, that's the European Consortium, Centre European Recherche Nucléaire in Switzerland. And basically they're bringing to they were implementing the Large Hadron Collider, which is in November, I believe, and it's going to try to discover what they call the guard particle, or the particle that it basically allows all matter to coalesce in,
mm-hmm.
in the universe.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, you'll see it more and more, and I don't know if you've heard much about Stephen Hawking, but he's getting more and more communicative lately. He has some fantastic books about, you know, he's the guy that basically brought the idea of black holes and wormholes and everything to the public.
Right, right. Yes, I have heard of him, and that's another fascinating arena, just a, or another fascinating facet to this whole thing.
Right.
Now, Charlie, how did you create Allie? How did you come up with this five generations of women who were all involved in one way or another in the scientific arena?
Well, let me give you a little background, and then I'll give you the story.
Okay.
My background is, you might even guess, my dad died when I was fairly young, and I was brought up with three brilliant women.
Mm.
My mother was an
it.
Artist, an art teacher, and paintings all over my house. She just recently died at 90.
Mm.
And I have two sisters that one was in the Peace Corps in the 60s, and the other one is, you know, a PhD from Harvard and a lawyer. And in banking, believe it or not, and even in science, you know, it's incredible in the whole area of technology. It's a very big area for women. So I've worked co-workers and people work for me, and I work for all kinds of situations with women. So it just sort of naturally came out when I started to write the story. I tried to think of, you know, a proposition that was real. And basically, so it's about really emerging women in science.
That is so profound. And having drawn on your own personal experience most of your life, being surrounded by strong, creative, talented, loving, compassionate women.
Yep.
That is wonderful. Well, Charlie, if there were a theme per se that you could touch on or that could be touched on about your book, what would it be?
Well, there's two themes. One is, I mentioned Stephen Hawking. You know, recently he made a comment on Yahoo, and it said, in the chaotic political, ecological, and social world that we live in, how are we going to survive the next 100 years? Well, basically, this book is a proposition of not sort of searching for the guilty and for the evildoers and the horrendous business and the, you know, the Syriana-type profiles of the world. It's a search for answers.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do to basically overcome what I call the strongest force in the universe, denial. And the
no
only way
kidding.
You can overcome the strongest force in denial is with really the collective will of positive action. So I think it's very timely, given that it's a political year. We have all this science going on that I mentioned. And also, just, you know, you have to be, you know, hiding under a rock not to see climatic, disease, war, terrorism. The world is shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a story about facing the reality of the shrinking world.
And I would, wouldn't you think perhaps that in addition to collective will, just collective thought, changing our thought from one of antagonism, hostility, whatever, to maybe more positive thought?
Yes, I agree. And I what I call it is the power of positive action.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I myself was influenced by the writings of The Power of Positive Thinking by Norman Vincent Peale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've read all his books, and I've always been a person that believed that positive action will overcome stagnancy, it'll overcome a vacuum. And what we have today is everybody's frozen because of the size and the complexity of the energy business and terrorism. It just seems that everybody's sort of frozen in despair. So
that's right.
The point is, there is forces that you can see that are out there that are beginning to coalesce. But I haven't seen anybody really say, well, let's put it all together. You know, you see, well, we're going to do this for biofuel, and we're going to do this for, you know, but where's the plan where you actually are going to affect change?
Well,
and that's the purpose of my book, is really to say, here's the shot. Now, if you have a better idea, let's go for it.
Oh, okay, because that was going to be my next question. Well, that's great. So your book is designed to offer some suggestions for change.
That's right.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, you know, and it is said that before action even begins to happen, there's a thought in the mind, and then that thought gets transferred into words, perhaps on hopefully on paper, and then action. So
that's
it's
right.
It's a flow, isn't it?
Yeah, and I try to say, you know, let's get step back, and in this case, what we're talking about, you see, is somebody from the future that already knows what happened. So you're really getting hindsight from the future.
Wow.
And hindsight is, of course, the best wisdom of all.
Mm.
So what I basically do is present five core issues in a different way than I think have been presented before. I call them the five oracles, and they say, don't just, you know, pick on this one and pick on that one. You have to step back and look at them all together, because the world is not about single causal interactions. It's about the integration and the synergy of all the things that are happening in the world today, i.e., you know, you have almost a billion automobiles, and all of a sudden you have Katrina.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what's called in science the butterfly effect.
Wow.
But in a real sense. I don't know if you know what a butterfly effect is.
Well, I have a vague idea, but please enlighten us, if you would.
Sure. Well, the butterfly effect is a concept really having to do with chaos theory. And what it says is a butterfly could be flapping their wings in Brazil in the middle of the rainforest,
mm-hmm.
and it could cause a hurricane in Texas.
Yeah.
And what they mean is you don't recognize, especially in the quantum world, that one action, you know, folds into another action, folds in, and when you get a certain combination of actions, it creates a whole effect you never, what they would call chaos, you never really expected it, i.e., how can you say that driving automobiles all over the world can cause Katrina? Well, the global warming warms the oceans of Africa, creating more storm clouds over over the Atlantic, and all of a sudden you have hurricanes that are greater than ever have been in the past.
That's right, enormous magnitudes, just enormous magnitudes. And, you know, there was a movie. There's a movie called The Butterfly Effect.
Yes.
Which
it's about that idea.
Tries to demonstrate that idea, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's amazing. And there seems to be a growing number of people who believe that in the chaos, the theory of chaos, which really is that there really is order. It's cause and effect in effect, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the idea of quantum science is that you have to recognize that when, you know, a very good analogy to understand how profound it is, mm-hmm. is that just take a look at the table that you have in front of you and hold it and touch it. Well, it's mostly empty space. You see, you're basically, that hard thing you're dealing with is mostly empty space. So what my story is when the computers get to the level of being able to basically miniaturize everything to the point where the computers themselves exist inside this empty space, then you're able to move them around and navigate them and take, the entire Library of Congress, which is all the books ever copyrighted in the United States, and basically put them in sort of a 1 meter little cube, but it's completely invisible. Mm. So you can port it, you know, you can take that intelligence and move it around, in this case, over 75 billion miles away.
Wow. It seems like a daunting concept, doesn't it?
Yes, but in reality, one of the analogies that I try to make people think of is, you know, when you step outside and look at that satellite in the air that's broadcasting down all those movies and everything, understand within the reach of a very small antenna, basically all the movies, the talk shows, the radio, it's all coming down to every point. You just put an antenna up and you receive it.
Mm-hmm.
But you're being bombarded with all this, and it's theoretically, hopefully, not even harming you. But the reason is you have to understand that when you take information and reduce it to such a small state, well, that's what can happen. Now, there's something called Moore's Law in the year, in the 60s. One of the gentlemen who created Intel, you know, the famous chip maker, he basically postulated that every 2 years, the density of the computer would be increased by a factor of two. So that means that doubling the density of data every 2 years. So I took that formula, because it's been true for the last 40 years, and I projected it out literally on a computer for 100 years. And instead of being, you know, you hear words like billions and gigabytes and gigahertz and those kind of terms today, what you end up with is what I call nanillion, or NN computing,
wow,
which is a million trillion trillionth of a meter. And you have to understand, when things get that small, that they can be propelled almost at light speed.
Wow. That's
and virtually take all the intelligence that we know of and put it in very small packets and utilize it. So the whole world of quantum science will be one of the most profound things that occurs in this era, because they're already, by the way, everything that I'm talking about is already in the labs of IBM and things like that.
Oh, yes.
They're all being tested. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take quite a while. So basically what I'm trying to do is say, well, that can give you a hypothesis of how you could move from basically through a space-time gateway back to the present, and then ask the question, well, if you could do it, what would you be willing to say from the future, because you already know what happened.
That's right.
And how would the forces of the status quo and the sort of bearers of the wealth and power of the world, how would they react to it? And that's essentially the essence of my story.
Well, that's really correct. I mean, if we could have a peek into the future, would we be smart enough and wise enough to be able to communicate back to a younger self, a younger group of selves, and maybe make some positive and corrective changes?
Right, and I believe, based on the extensive research, of course, not only about the future, but also about what's going on today, most of my data is from what you call the CIA Factbook. And by the way, the CIA Factbook is available to anyone on the Internet. It's government data, and basically it does the demographics of the entire world and all the trends that are occurring and everything.
Really?
And it's all there. Just go into Google and punch in CIA Factbook, and it'll be amazing to you what pours out.
Wow. Okay, audience, did you hear that? Google.
Yeah, it's just there. And that's the whole point about the Internet and the availability of information. You have to understand how to dissect it, and you also have to take that information and then find the relevant books and then go through them. Because in order for me to get through this, I as I get deeper and deeper, I ended up taking a course in quantum physics, and I read Einstein's theory of relativity. I read everything that Stephen Hawking wrote, and you know, and really started to step back and understand it all. And really, just as a background, because that's not really this is a little primer for the reader in quantum physics, but don't be afraid of it, because I have all kinds of appendices and things to
refer people to
make it understandable, and even my own take on if time travel could occur.
Mm-hmm.
This is probably the kind of scenario that would have to exist in order for that to be true. So with the credibility of that, then we move in and we start looking at the real-world data, the fact that 47% of the Earth's population is under health and economic stress. 47% of 6.4 billion people. Well, one thing I get into is if you have to look at the turn of the century in the 19th to the 20th century, in the first 25 years and all the amazing things that occurred, you know, we also had something called World War One, where 15 million died, but more importantly, we had a pandemic in 1918 and 19 that, mm-hmm. that, by the way, no one knows how many died, but it ranges from 40 to 100 million people.
Wow.
And that
would be
interesting
with the possibility of another one.
Spanish influenza.
Mm-hmm.
And that occurred as a result of the people coming together and fighting in Europe. Somebody brought the disease into the battle, and everybody went home and spread it.
Oh, my.
And so there's, again, the idea of things that you wouldn't think. You know, you're bringing together in this horrible war people from all over the world, and what do? You end up killing more people from the spread of the disease than from the war itself. Now, when you think about our shrinking globe today, and you think about words like AIDS, sarcoma, mad cow disease, terrorism, when you think of the dynamics of all that, and then realize one thing, all that World War One was in a population of 1.5 billion. We now live in a world of 6.5 billion and growing to 9, and probably by the end of the century, even 10 or 11 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, the paradigm has to change. It is not, you know, we live in a global neighborhood, and it has to be recognized. And when you look at the numbers, you say, how can the world, you know, persist? You know, there's 600 million people in the world, mostly in Africa, some in Asia, where their average lifespan is 49, and basically their per capita income is less than $1,000, where our per capita GDP in the United States at the time of my writing was $40,000, and now it's $42,000. Basically, the 15% of the world is growing in tremendous wealth, and 47% of the world is in stress.
Right,
and
that's right.
You have to ask yourself, you know, let's take the shield of denial off ourselves and ask yourself, can this persist?
And the answer is no, not safely.
No. And can you hide? Can you build a wall big enough to hide behind it?
Hasn't been built yet, has it?
Has it? Well, they're talking about building one between the United States and Mexico, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, and the point is, if you want to fix the wall, the problems between Mexico and the United States, you have to do something about Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the major points I bring up in my oracles, is that we're dealing with a major energy crisis, but people don't recognize as clearly as they should of the tremendous water crisis that's existing.
Well, that's right.
And basically, 500 million people, 500 million to a billion people are in water stress right now, but it's projected to go up to 4 billion in 30 years. So this is also effect of global warming and all those dynamics. So,
and it's just no longer something we can afford to keep our head in the sand about.
That's right, and the United States is part of it. Western United States, southwestern United States,
mm-hmm.
Mexico, South America, Asia, China.
We're all playing in this.
And India, they're all part
mm-hmm.
of it.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So the point is, you've got to really start asking new questions and saying, you know, how are we going to exist in a free society, in a society that's fundamentally built on free trade, but what are the rules of engagement for the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, you cannot continue to repeat history because the devastation will be much greater.
Mm.
And I calculate out, actually, in the story that we can save, in the first half of this century, we can save more lives than all the wars, the pandemics, and the genocides in the last two centuries combined. Because the dynamics of all this population growth and the devastation that's occurring with basically things that have to do with, underneath it all, the energy and water crisis. And people are not looking at those two as a combined issue. And it is a combined issue because the hope of bringing water to where it's needed in the world is, to a large extent, through desalination, taking of this, growing seawater,
mm-hmm.
and converting it to fresh water.
Right.
Well, the reason it's not expanding as fast as it should is because the cost to create it is too high. Why? Because of the cost of energy. So basically, I bring together the issues of energy and water and say, look, we have to go to renewables. We don't have any choice. And at the end of the day, leadership will respond to the currency of votes. And we have to change the mix of society. And I repeat many times, and by the way, it is a part of my book that's in, I think, Chapter 7 in the 22nd century, where they go and visit a museum which compares the centuries. And essentially my hero, Jacques, in the 22nd century, explains it to a 12-year-old. And that was my only point. I'm going to first explain it to the 12-year-old, and then later in the book, I'm going to have Allison come and explain it to the United Nations on the floor of the General Assembly. But essentially, that you have to commit to change. And you can't just say, well, we're going to add 35 billion gallons of biofuel in the next 10 or 15 years. Well, people don't know the numbers, so I'm presenting you with the numbers. The numbers... in the United States, we use 300 billion gallons, so 35 billion, and that's at today's volumes, not 10 years from now, going to affect the change.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You have to understand how large the numbers are and realize you need what I call an enterplex of solutions. You need to be offering at the gas pump electrical, gaseous, and biofuels. And
well,
if you don't think in the large numbers, the problems are going to persist.
Right, and I think there's a growing awareness. And the book, Charlie, your book sounds like not only an exciting and fascinating read, but it also sounds like an opportunity for us to become better educated on what's going on and what we can do to effect a shift, as you said, a paradigm shift even.
Yes.
And we are getting dangerously close to running out of time here. And before we do, Charlie, you have a website, right?
Yes.
Would you please tell the audience what your website is?
Well, it's my publisher's site at the moment, and it's outskirtspress.com / turn of the century, all small letters.
Okay. Fabulous. And I do want everyone to know that this interview is going to be posted to your author's page on Inside Scoop Live, and that's Charlie Peterson, P-E-D-E-R-S-O-N, or S-E-N,
S-E-N.
beg your pardon, mm-hmm. and ReaderView's website and the publisher's website will all have links to this interview. So, Charlie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great.
And audience, thank you for tuning in to this segment of Inside Scoop Live. Take a look, take a listen, consider this book for your own information as well as sharing it as a gift. Thank you so much. Until the next time, bye.